Okay. Good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. Learning this morning is sponsored by Elaine and Larry Grossman and Diane and Ephraim Goldstein in memory of Elaine and Diane's father, Eric Hanau, Rav Avram ben Reb Tzvi, Oliver Shalom, and Shema Havna Leah. Our learning is in his memory. May his memory continue to be a blessing. So we're on Daf Yud Zayin today. You've got two sheets. Apologies for that. We're halfway down Tet Zayin Amud Bet, where the yellow begins. We did a couple of lines of that. And we'll pivot today onto Yud Zayin, which looks a lot thicker, but essentially is one brighter, which we'll get to. And then that's Amud Aleph, and then Amud Bet is the destruction of the logic of that brighter that simultaneously rips apart the idea that it's got any coherence, while also praising the author of the brighter as the most worthy human being to have ever lived, essentially. So we'll come to that in a moment, but we're still finishing our remarks on the first mission of the Perek, which again listed all sorts of prohibitions for which you get lashes. Kamalokin, who gets lashes, and we've got a list that includes people who are in breach of marital laws, people who are in breach of sacred space laws, people who are in breach of all sorts of eating laws, and we're kind of in the midst of talking about eating. And over the last few dapim, we've discussed various exceptions to this application of lashes. We've suggested that there's a necessity that the biblical text not only says this is prohibited, but warns you that it's prohibited. Otherwise, you might imagine it's not a moral concern. It's just like if I borrow money, I owe you money. So if I eat this, I get lashes. And there's not a moral issue at stake. It's just, you know, if you want to have lobster, just be willing to have lashes, and that's fine. And that's the cost of doing business. So the Gemara assumes there's got to be an azhara, because malchus is never just the cost of doing business. It is not just a, you know, if you know, parking fines are not a way to support the judicial system where they, you know, let's have a fine. So if you park badly, we'll take money and you keep the system. Ideally, the judicial system should want no parking fines. However cynically we may view that, they should want none, because it's a moral shame that that's being done. So we assume there's got to be an azara for lashes to be applied. We assume if there's no act involved, there's no lashes. If it's a passive violation, we also assume if there is a way to remedy it, nitak la'aseh, if the Gemara or the Torah rather gives you a way to remedy what you've done, don't leave it over, but if you do, burn it. Don't steal, but if you do, return it. All these varieties, there was a debate we'll have again in our Mishnah that we quoted last week. If you do not take away the mother bird before you're taking the eggs and you kind of snatch them all together, do you put them all back and then send the mother bird away and you've now remedied the situation, or is that not a remedy? But there's an assumption across the board that if there's a remedy, you don't get punished. There was a debate within that, is what happens if you refuse to do the remedy? Say, you got to burn the notar, the leftover meat, and you say, nah, can the court say, I'm going to count to three, and then if you haven't done it, we're going to whip you? Or can the court say, as long as you don't entirely obliviate the possibility of doing it, we're not going to lash you, because there's always a chance. So the question was, if you're holding a bird in your hand, if you don't kill that bird, in theory, you've got until the bird dies to do it. And if the bird dies, that wasn't you, so you never got rid of the possibility. So even though there's no remedy on the table, it's only if you obliterate the possibility of remedy that we consider that to be a violation worthy of lashes. And we had an unusual case where if the Torah gives a remedy before the violation, you have to marry this young woman and stay married to her. So there was a debate about whether that was a being told to remarry her if you divorce her, if that's a remedy, or if that's just you've got to go back to the way things were and now you're going to get punished. And it turns out that that was not a case of love shekadmo aseh, where there's a remedy in advance, because the pasuk says kol yamav. And there's essentially one case where the Torah has a love shekadmo aseh, which is if you are impure, we're told go outside the camp. And if you go into the Beit Mikdash, you have to leave. And we say that's not a remedy, because it said before you have to leave the camp. So that's the one example where there is a remedy, where you have to leave the Beit Mikdash and you get lashes anyway, which would be the example the Havda we gave. If a kid in class, I say, stay in your seat, nobody messed around, and then they start parading around the room, and I say, come back to your seat, and they sit down. They can say, okay, I restored order. I'm like, very nice, but you still disobeyed me, you're still going to get punished. So that's the one example we had. And As we start this halfway down in the yellow on page Tet Zion Amud Bet, we have been, again, trying to find a case or trying to carve out issues where you don't get lashes. And this is where we've got this comeback with a vengeance, as we said last week, and forgive the terminology, is that the Gemara says this is not like a queasiness about punishment. That we're trying to carve out all these exceptions. We're trying to just model what Malkus are about, which is about remedial civic duty. We need people. We're not just in the business of hurting people. We don't see ourselves as agents of divine punishment. This is about God trying to make us sustain society in a healthy way, which involves enforcing moral laws, which means even if no one's getting hurt, and we're going to have some prime examples of that, even if no one's getting hurt, we will enforce these penalties, even though we've been carving out exceptions where we wouldn't. So, Rav Yehuda says, Haiman da'achol b'nentei derei karbev. Somebody eats a worm inside a lettuce. Who's getting hurt in this scenario? The worm, but nobody else. Malkinan le mishum shoretz ha'shoretz ala aretz. They get lashes for eating a creepy crawly on land. And in terms of background, there is a maximal possibility of 8 prohibitions against eating a sheretz. And as we read this, I guess it's worth thinking about if you were designing, I think Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan's got a book where he says, imagine your God. And he asked you to, like, imagine you've taken over an island, what kind of rules would you put in place? So as we think through this, imagine you're designing a society. What kind of moral laws would you say, I want to encourage the citizenry to observe, aside from don't hurt each other? What would sustain society? And here we've got 8 possible violations if you eat a creepy crawly. What is at the root of that? Why would that have anything to do with a healthy society? You eating a mouse. 8 lashes? We've just carved out exceptions for if you horrifically abuse a human being, there are possibilities you won't get lashed if there's a lav shenitzik la'aseh. And here we say you're going to get smashed. You're going to get hit 8 times if you eat a creepy quote. I'm not pushing the question for you to answer, but it's to think about what is at the root of this. And to some degree, my question assumes that we can discover reasons, that there is ta'amei ha-mitzvot, that there are reasons. And that is an assumption I'm making, which one could disagree with. But on the basis of the themes we've been reading, why are we enforcing this? And as we get through, maybe some ideas will pop into mind. So we said, if you eat these, as I was saying, there are 8 maximal violations. There are 2 standard violations for a sheretz, meaning any creepy crawly, however we're going to define that, you're going to get 2 minimally. If it's a creepy crawly that lives in the water, there are an extra 2. So if you've got any creepy crawly from the water, which I guess, like an eel, we call it an eel, yeah, why not? It creeps, doesn't really crawl. So you would get 4, because it's a general sheretz and it lives in the water. If it's a creepy crawly that lives on the land, you get 5. So you eat a mouse. Standard 2 plus the 3 of land. And if it flies, for example, a wasp, you get, it's also a land creature because it lands on the land. So you get the 2 standard, the 3 land, and 1 for flying.
Do you have to get hasra on each one?
It seems like no. It seems like you just need to be warned that you will be in violation if you eat this creature. And it kind of, it's a package deal. One for 8. And there's a question, if it lives in all 3, meaning it can fly, goes on the land, and it's in the water, you'd get 8. And again, this sounds like disproportional punishment when there are all sorts of laws that we've now carved out as being exceptions. So the Gemara can Hahud Achal Bendede Karba, first word in the line is Al. There was a person who ate one of these worms, V'nagde Rav Yehuda, and Rav Yehuda gave him Malkus. And as we noted last week, Rashi and Tosfot start debating, what's the Chiddush? What is being innovated in telling us that Rav Yehuda gave him Malkus? You just told us you're Chayv Malkus. Oh, and you know what happened? Rav Yehuda even gave him Malkus. Obviously. So Rashi and Tosfot try to suggest maybe there's something novel about this case. Tosfot says, oh, maybe this kind of worm originates in the water. So you might not have thought it's a land animal, so there's... And what we suggested last week, that aside from these technical innovations, maybe the innovation is having just carved out all these exceptions and we're kind of feeling like maybe we're queasy about Malkus. The Gemara says, no, somebody ate one of these worms and Rabbi Yehuda said, I'm not carving out exceptions because I feel compassion. These exceptions were because it's about how to remedy treatment. And if you eat this, I will enforce the punishment. And Buddha says, if you eat one of these shrutsim, your behavior puts society at risk, and I'm willing to mete out the punishment and push. Yeah.
Are all of these eight considered equivalent, or does the principle of kumbhaya apply?
The principle Debbie's invoking is if you you can only get one punishment at a time. This you would get all eight if the doctor said you could cope with it. It's because it's not two separate forms of punishment. It's not money and malchus or malchus and misa. As long as what you do in the same act is warranted multiple punishment, you would get all of them. Yeah. So it's not a good day. Well, double jeopardy may come up in the sense that if you get accused of a crime and then what's the opposite of convicted?
Exonerated.
You may not be able to be accused of that crime again. But the idea that before a verdict is passed, you could get multiple punishments, that would not...
No, there's one act.
Correct. Correct. So Amar Abaya. We had a case a couple of weeks ago. Somebody has a relationship with a woman who is simultaneously their sister, their mother's sister, and their father's sister. Bless you, they'd be in violation of three different prohibitions, and they would get three sets of lashes for that. So Amar Abaya says, Achal Potita, if you eat one of these water creatures, Loka Rabah, you get four lashes. Namala, if you eat a worm, not a worm, an ant. Loka, an ant. Loka Chamesh Mishum Sharetz HaSharetz Ala Aretz, you get five. So he said, you eat an ant, you get five sets of lashes. If I'm calculating that, you're getting, I was not figuring the nine. You're like 180 something lashes for eating an ant. So Ra, if you eat one of these land and air creatures like a wasp or a hornet, Loka Shesh Mishum Sharetzos, you get six. And here's where we get maybe a little bit of an inflection that suggests what's the problem. What's the problem with the Sharetz? If you were to say, I'm going to jump on the Tamei HaMitzvot bandwagon and try to give my explanation of why God says Shrotzim are a problem, what do you think the problem is? Is Tamei meaning?
Like you can't, you're not powerful, so you can't do other things. It has to be Tamei.
Interesting. And why does God designate these creatures as Tamei? Meaning, what's behind it? Is it arbitrary that God says, I want to have some orders? So in the Middle Ages, there was a large push among a number of the commentators, the Sefer Achinuch and others, to say, the Rambam goes along this route sometimes, that maybe some of these creatures are carry diseases or can be physically damaging to you, so God wants you to steer away. And if that's the reading, you could see why there is this huge amount of punitive response, meaning this is like, don't breathe smallpox in people's face. It may seem like, we'll put aside the controversy around it, but Lahavdil, you can imagine someone saying, you're going to carve out an exception if somebody commits a relationship that they shouldn't. But if I don't put my mask on, you're going to like penalize me and, you know, whip me. It's just a little mask. And so, well, yes, it's just a little mask. But if we take the presumption that you taking it off could kill a room full of people, you could imagine why there'd be such a huge pushback. And if the idea is these creatures carry diseases, you know, eating an ant, you're going to punish me. And if somebody has a relationship with or they abuse this woman, they've got the rest of their life to remarry her. What are you talking about? So, well, yes, there is harm done socially to the fabric of society if somebody abuses somebody and refuses to look after them. But they're not, you know, if eating an ant carries a disease that could then you could get infected, and it makes sense. So there is a reason why the medieval figures go down that route. Challenge is, we don't see diseases in these animals in more prevalence now than we do in kosher animals. It could be in the medieval period there was. But it seems to be, if we look at the next line, that what is beneath these shrutzim is a sense of revulsion, a sense of debasement, which I guess could be subjective. Have any of you visited the Far East? Anyone of you been to a trip to China? No? All right, well, I'll save your trip. My parents went on a trip a couple years ago, and my mother sent me a picture from one of the market stalls, in China. And they have, like, you know, like these kebab things with, like, chunks of chicken on? they have a kebab with like a line of scorpions and a line of spiders or a line of ants. And it's not like a show for tourists. That's like a snack. So like I look at that and I think, oh, but clearly they're doing business. So some people don't think it's a problem. In fact, in a number of UN offices that work on the issues of hunger suggest that if African nations who have a huge amount of people beneath the poverty line just started eating ants, it's a huge source of protein, and they could solve the hunger problem overnight. And there are all these groups that advocate insect consumption. And again, if they're not Jewish, there's no kind of prohibition on eating these creatures. But there seems to be a prohibition here. I'm Rabbi Chai. This is Rabbi Chai, and I have to confess, this is a violation that I'm not very good at avoiding. Over Rav Chai says, as an extension of this, if somebody holds himself from going to the bathroom when they need to, you're in violation of this principle of Bal Tishak, so you should not make yourself revolting, or you should not repulse yourself. And again, as a rabbi, actually, this is quite difficult. Shabbos morning, I can't just go to the bathroom when I want. You know, there are announcements to make, and you've got to give tefillot to certain places. So it's, and generally, I'm on policy against movement. So if I'm sitting in a chair, it takes a lot to get me out of a chair. But I remember from high school being told that this is a prohibition, and you've got to go, you've got to go. And that was the principle why you didn't have to put your hand up at some point in high school and ask, may I go to the bathroom? If you need the loo, bathroom, go to the loo, and that's it. And this is the policy. But again, what has that got to do with eating these creatures? It seems to be the condition in which you hold yourself has a huge amount of impact on the social fabric. And if you have people walking around demeaning themselves in the way that they eat, or the way that they relieve themselves, it's not a private issue. It's private in the sense that we may not know about it, but it has consequences for people around you and society, and we're going to enforce this. I'm Rav Bibi Bar Abaye. Rav Bibi says, "Hai man deshatim bekarna de umnen." If somebody drinks, says, you know, I'm really thirsty, and they drink out of one of these bloodletting tubes, ka'avah mishum la deshaktu. It's the same thing. Anything that is a violation of what we might call etiquette is a prohibition akin to eating these shratzim. And there is a debate about whether this is biblical or rabbinic, the holding yourself from going to the loo. I mean, can you imagine giving somebody hasra for this? It's like walking around saying, do you need the loo? Because if you do and you don't go, I've got two witnesses here, they're watching, and you're going to get lashed. It's like a very, and is that a lav shein bo maaseh? Or is it lav shenitik laaseh? I'm going to go to the loo in a second. Oh, there's no act. Meaning, we're not talking about how do you enforce these things. This is about painting a picture of what is beneath these prohibitions and what are we willing to enforce. Where in theory, no one is being harmed. Can you imagine anything less harmful to other people? Eating an ant. I said, who's being harmed with the worm? The answer was the worm. Who's being harmed if I don't go to the loo and I need it? It's my business. You know, get out of my life. And what we're being told is, no, it's not your business. Because that the way that you behave impacts people around you. Amar Rava Bar Rav Huna. Rabbi Rahuna says, Risik Tishin the Malim, if you crush up nine ants, Vahivi Achachai, and you bring one more that's alive, Eshliman Lakazait Lokavav, and you have this paste of nine crushed ants together with one whole ant, and you eat it, and it adds up to a Kazayath, you get six, which is Hamish and Beria, you get five because you've had a whole Sheretz, which comes with all these prohibitions, Vachamishim Kazayath Nevela, and one because you've had a Kazayath of dead animal. Which implies that if you only had ant paste that was all crushed up, you're not in violation of shratzim. You're in violation of non-kosher food, but to be in violation of shratzim to the fullest extent, it has to be a whole creature. And Tosfot and others suggest this is because it doesn't say the word achal, or eating, in the context of some of these prohibitions, so it's got to be eaten as a whole animal. Rav Amar Rabbi Yochanan Afilu Shneimvo says it doesn't have to be nine, even if it's two ants that are crushed up. And one hole, you'd get punished. Rav Yosef Amar Afilu Echad Vahu, even if it's one ant. Anyone ever seen an ant that with one crushed ant and one live ant, you'd add up to a kazayas? Any of you got ready for Pesach yet and see those charts for the size of the matzah? Can you imagine that two ants filling up that amount of space? So that's a possibility. The truth is, I've seen pictures of big ants, and they're horrible. And I don't know if they're dense or not, and if you crush them up, who knows? Don't experiment. But the Gemara finishes this line of inquiry, lo plige haber, babai haber, is a try. And they're not debating about whether 2, 1, 9, they're just talking about some with big, some with small. You shouldn't think, oh, it's got to be 9. Like, in theory, if it's one crushed ant and one whole ant, you'd be violation of 6 if it adds up to a keziah. And the truth is, if it was one live ant that added up to a keziah on its own, you'd be in violation of all 6. It's just unlikely you're going to find one ant that's the size of a keziah. Even if you're thinking just about the size of an olive, like literally, it's hard to find an ant that size. So full stop. Now, the Gemara picks up with the next point in the Mishnah, which again, if we're thinking about what are you enforcing in society, what is considered a threat? Achal tevel, maaser rishon. Somebody who eats tevel. What's tevel? Tevel is any grain from which you've not taken the designations that you have an obligation to take. So if I'm a farmer, and have you ever done farming? I think I've asked this before. None of you have been involved with farming. I ask this in YU to students occasionally. Don't ask me why. Oh, when I'm teaching Bereshis, when we're talking about farming and Cain and Hevel, and there's always somebody who's like, oh yeah, I want to be a farmer. Or oh, I've got a cousin who's a farmer. And of course, if you've got family in Israel, it's not that unusual to have somebody who's a farmer or in farming. So if you've got a whole collection of grain and you bring it in, there are a number of things you need to take away. Any of you accountants? Involved in accounting? Have an accountant?
Pay taxes.
Pay taxes, there you go. So I've filled in forms, but I don't do the accounting. And it looks to me like there are a lot of things you've got to think about. Are you taking this deduction and that deduction? Do you work for this? Yeah, there are a lot of details. So there are details. If you're a farmer, you have to take off from your grain. There are principally 4 designations, depending on the year. The first thing you have to do when you gather grain, you have to take truma. Truma is for whom? The Kohanim. How much do you have to take? Yeah, minimally is as much, as little as you need. There were practices set up about how much is reasonable, what's called an average, what's called a good amount, what's called a cheap amount. But in reality, set aside some truma. You then need to take maaser rishon. How much is that? That's 10%. So let's say you've got 100 pieces of grain, to make it easy to figure out. 100 pieces of grain. Truma you're going to take 1 grain. It's, you know, it'll be more than that, but take 1. Maaser rishon you're going to take 10 grains. So you've now lost 11 grains from your stock. So we're looking at the tax rate here. So you've got 11 grains are gone. You then take maaser sheni. How much is maaser sheni? 10%. So that's another 10 grains. Where does the maaser rishon go, by the way? The first 10 grains that you've taken away? That goes to the Levi. Does the Levi have any obligations about, other than eating it? So they've got Trumat Maaser. They have to take 10% of that 10% and give it to the Kohanim. So that, how many is that? 1 grain. So the Kohen's now got 2 grains from your thing. 1 from the Levi and 1 from you. So you've got the Truma, the Maaser Rishon, the Maaser Sheni. Who gets to eat the Maaser Sheni? Say again? So that's Maaser Ani will come to. Maaser Sheni, you eat it, but you have to eat in Yerushalayim. So you don't quite lose it. The tax isn't a way to force you to go to Yerushalayim to eat this food if you want it. There are ways to redeem it so you can spend the money in Yerushalayim instead. But it'd be the equivalent of giving people tax deductions in rural New York if they spend it in Manhattan, Lahavdil. I think that's the way it's set up. It forces you to go to Yerushalayim. That's a good question. Meaning, could you just send somebody to go and invest it? I don't know.
If you're supposed to leave Yerushalayim, you don't eat it, so other people can have it.
Right, meaning you could go to Yerushalayim with the food and just donate it to a food bank in Yerushalayim.
If you don't finish it, you're supposed to leave it.
Right, so I guess the question is that Bidi Eved or is that Lechatchila?
So you don't want to go to Yerushalayim, can you pay someone the money or you redeem it?
You could have an Uber Eats Maaser Sheni. Just go and take it to Yerushalayim and eat it. I'll pay you.
Donate to the food bank in Yerushalayim.
Right. Meaning that's what it could be. It could be this is how you make a metropolis function. And if you think about the government spending, the amount of spending that happens to house or give care to the homeless in Manhattan is off the scales compared to how much is being paid in rural Idaho. So it makes sense you're going to design a system to help support around an inhabited city. And so we've got Maaser Rishon, Maaser Sheni. And in the 7-year cycle, on year 3 and 6, there's no Maaser Sheni. Instead, there's Maaser Ani, which is a tenth that has to go to the poor. So that's all you have to designate. Now, what am I have to do these things, but what am I prohibited to eat? What is our separate prohibition? So truma, you could get the death penalty for eating truma. That's a really big problem, to eat truma. That belongs to the Kohen. It's sacred. And because it's sacred, you're in violation not just of property that belongs to somebody else, but sacred food. You can't eat that. Maser Rishon belongs to the Levi. That's property, but you don't get punished for eating it per se, other than theft. So you've got to pay the equivalent or something, but it's not a, it's a monetary issue. Maser Ani is also a monetary issue. But the problem with Maser Rishon that belongs to the Levi, what is within Maser Rishon? Trumat Maser. So until that is taken, you could be in violation of eating truma too. So Maser Rishon, you shouldn't eat because there's a truma hidden in there.
It's a punishment for that,
Kari, so. I think that's also Misa.
Capital punishment.
Yeah. Yeah, so be careful eating truma. I'll don't take my word for that. But I'm pretty sure that's true. And I don't want to take time checking for you. But we'll, I will check. So now that we've designated all of those pieces, Maser Ani, there is no truma hidden in that. Maser Sheni, there's also a prohibition because it's got to be eaten Yerushalayim. But, and we'll get to the various punishments on that, but Maser Ani is just a monetary thing. I owe the money. So the question is going to be at the bottom of the page here, Amar Rav, this is right after the gray. Rav says, Achal Tevel Shemaser Ani, Loke. He says, if you eat Tevel Ev Maser Ani, meaning you've got all your grain, and you've taken away everything apart from Maser Ani, meaning you've got 100 pieces of the grain, you took one off for Truma, done. You've taken Maser Rishon off for the Levi, they can take the Truma, Trumat Maser, done. It's year 3 of the cycle. So all you've got left to take now is Maser Ani. And you say, oh, I hate those poor. I'm not giving them Maser Ani, I'm just going to eat. So at this point, you've taken off Truma, you've taken off Maser. Is there still a violation to eat Tevel if the only thing you haven't taken is Maser Ani? And I guess at some level the question is the prohibition against Tevel because you are eating sacred food, or is the violation something deeper than this? Because if you've taken Truma, and I've taken Maser Rishon, so there's no Truma Maser here, it's just eating the property belongs to the poor. It's like a violation in the realm of Staka. You're going to hit me for this? And Rav says, yes. This is not about, you know, between man and God and eating sacred food. The prohibitions here are about how to sustain society and enforcing moral law. And that also includes supporting the poor. And the Gemara says, come on, who is Rav following here in saying that eating Tevel, even if the only thing you haven't taken is Maser Ani, you get whipped? Ki haitanda de tanya. It's like the following teaching. I'm Rabbi Yossi, in the line of Rabbi Yossi. Yachol yechayv el ala tevel shlo hurim menu al kol yikar. You might think you only get malchus if you eat tevel that you've taken nothing from. Hurim menu truma gedolah lo hurim menu maser rishon. But what happens if you've taken truma gedolah ben maser rishon, maser rishon lo maser sheni, or you've taken maser rishon below maser sheni, va'afilu maser ani? And what, maybe you haven't taken the only thing in maser ani you haven't taken. Minayin, how do I long you get, know you get punished? For that, Talmud Lom, it says in the Pasuk, Lo tuchal le'echol b'sha'arecha. You cannot eat within your gates. And then the Pasuk continues. And actually, if you look to the left, where it says Torah or Hashalim, directly across from your finger to the left, there's a Pasuk v'chol ha'sheretz underneath that. That's Pasuk Bet. If you go down to Pasuk Hey, which is like in line with the second last line of Rashi, Lo tuchal le'echol b'sha'arecha. You cannot eat in your gates. Ma'asar degancha. A tenth of your corn, v'tiroshcha, v'yisarecha, or your wine or your oil stock, v'charot b'karecha, and then it continued with other things you can't eat, the first of your flock, v'tzonecha, or your cattle, inverse. V'chol nedarecha, shetidor, nedarecha, trumat yadecha, and there's a whole bunch of things that you can't eat them, and you'll be violating. The only reason I read that pasuk out loud is because the brighter on the next page is essentially identifying what each one of those things is, and it doesn't quote the whole pasuk at once. So we'll come to that briefly over the page. So, on the basis of that pasuk, which says, Lo tuchal lechol sharecha, you cannot eat maser dagancha in your gates. That maybe sounds like maser rishon. How do I know that's maser? Ani, ulahalanu omer, this is the first word in line of sharecha. Later it says, Va'achlu b'sha'arecha v'saveyu, and you shall eat in your gates and be joyous. Malahalan maser ani, afkan maser ani, in both cases, sha'arecha refers to maser ani. Va'amrachmane lo tuchal, and the Torah says, you cannot in this case. So, Rabbi Yossi, bottom line, takes a view that if you've taken, separated everything off from your grain, apart from Maser Ani, Now, again, because none of us are accountants, I don't know how to give the model here. But let's say I've paid most of my taxes. Oh, well, this is the clue. When you buy a house in New York City, if the house is more expensive than $1 million, i.e. if you buy a house anywhere in Queens, you have to pay what's called a mansion tax, which is 1% of whatever the final price is. I don't know how it gets spent or what it's designated to, but let's say you say, I pay all my taxes, but I've just bought a studio apartment in Manhattan, and I refuse to call this a mansion. So I'm not paying the mansion tax. So is it the same? You're not paying taxes, you get violated. You're eating teva, you're eating something where you haven't taken everything off, you get violated. Or is it just, well, no, the main taxes that come out of income, but mansion tax, that's a separate issue we'll deal with through the courts. Is that meaning, that's the question Rabiosi asked. And he says, no, any agricultural tax that you haven't taken and you've started eating, you're in violation, including if it's Masa Ani. It's not, there's nothing sacred here. It's just a monetary issue. So we said, that's the view of Rabiosi. Three lines up, Amar Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef said, Ketanai. Maybe this is a debate between Mishnaic figures. And it's not straightforward that that's what our Mishnah means, because maybe there's two views on the subject. As we'll see, maybe this is the case. Rabbi Laza Omer, Rabbi Laza says, Ein sarach likrot et Hashem al masa ani shel damai. Now, anyone familiar with damai? Right, damai is questionable grain. And the premise of the case is, somebody comes to the market, or somebody comes to your house selling grain, and they are what we call an Am Haaretz. How do we define Am Haaretz?
Not man of the land, not knowing the laws of Chumas
Amaretz. Right, man of the land, not knowing laws. So it gets defined differently in different places, and actually we can have a debate now, what is meant by Am Haaretz? And oddly, or interestingly, none of the views will maintain somebody who doesn't know the laws. That's usually what we assume Am Haaretz means. It's going to give two options. About what Am Haaretz means. But the assumption is this is somebody who doesn't practice the laws, at minimum. Somebody who doesn't practice the laws, or we're worried that maybe they don't, because they seem like a less committed person. So they bring grain, and you think to yourself, did they take Truma? Did they take Masa? Did they Masa Ani? So the view of Rabbi Lazar is, what do I have to do? Meaning, I'm buying grain now. If I buy food from a store that says it's kosher, do I have to start doing my investigations? Do I have to start doing stuff to it? Or can I rely on them? So somebody sells grain at my door. I'm not sure about their commitment. Do I have to do anything? Rabbi Lazar says, Ein sarach lekrot et Hashem al masa ani shel damai. If it's a case where your assumption is they've taken everything apart from masa ani, you don't have to designate masa ani aside. Why not? Who does masa ani... If you know that Maser Ani needs to be taken, it's his responsibility, but I guess Maser Rishon is as well. But Maser Rishon belongs to who, in theory? The Levi, with a little bit that belongs to Kohanim that is sacred. Maser Ani belongs to the poor. So it's a monetary designation. So the Ani would also have to do Maser, but, oh, interesting, to a Maser Ani. I don't know if they have to do Truma. I don't... If they did, then there would be a violation here as well, because there's Truma hidden in there. So the assumption is either they don't, or they do, but it's a kind of rabbinic enactment rather than a necessity. But we'll have to double check that. I'm not sure. So Rabbi Lazar says, if somebody, you're not sure if they took Masa Ani, you don't have to separate Masa Ani, because essentially it's a monetary issue and it's a suffix. And what's the rule when it's a monetary? Meaning, if I've got money in my pocket and we don't know who it belongs to, what law kicks in to prove who it belongs to? Right. The principle is Hamotzi Mechaver Alav Arai. If you want to take this out of my hand, the burden of proof is on you. I've got a $10 bill in my hand and you say, oh, that doesn't belong to you. That belongs to me. I can say, well, what's your proof? And say, I don't need proof. I'm telling you. Like, well, you do, because it's in my hand. And that's at least some evidence that it's mine. Unless you can prove that I stole it, you don't get it back. So in a case of doubt, Masa Ani, the Ani can complain, but Hamotzi Mechaver, if you want to get it out of me, you're going to have to prove it. So he said you don't need to even designate. The Chachamim say over the page, onto Yud Zayin, Kared Hashem Ve'enu Sarach LaHafrish. You have to designate, this is Masa Ani, and say, I'm taking aside Masa Ani, But you don't actually have to separate it aside and then give it to an ani. You can let it mix in, and then a mazmei chaver lavarai. So for the chacham, it's important to state it. And now we're going to try and see, is anybody here of the view that there's no violation of eating tevel if you refuse to take ma'aseh ani? Who might you say has that view? To Rav Blaz and the Chachamim. Rav Blaz says you don't need to designate it. And the Chachamim say you need to designate it, but you don't have to separate it out. Sounds like the Rav Blaz might be of the view that it's not really tevel. So you don't have to worry about it. So that's where the Gemara is assuming. My love, Baka Mefilagi, surely this is what they're debating. Tamar Sava Vaidai Tavlo, Mar Sava Vaidai Enu Tavlo. That one view says, oh, if you know you need to designate Ma'aseh Ani, one person says it's tevel unless you do that, so you need to designate it but not separate it. And the other view says, no, it's not tevel, and you don't even need to say it out loud. Amalei Abai says, Ihachi, Ad Miflagu Besfeka, Liflagu Bavadai. If that's true, why do they have this whole convoluted case where it's Damai, I'm not sure. We just have the debate about this is Ma'aseh Ani. Can I eat it or not? Why do you have to get convoluted? So that can't be. It must be everybody agrees with the view we had in the name of Rabbi Yossi over the page. If you eat from grain that Ma'aseh Ani has not been separated from, that's Tevel. You get lashes. This is a violation, a crime. Bahacha bahaka miflagi, and this is what they're debating here. How do we classify Ama'aretz? Now, I mentioned this in passing to Jay yesterday in Shul because it came up incidentally. But there's always jokes being said, like, if you're in a frum office and every day somebody's eating your sandwich and you come every day, or you've got a yogurt in the fridge and every day somebody eats your yogurt and you've written your name on it and they keep eating and you're like, please don't eat, and they keep eating it. And how can I stop them eating my food? And of course, you put the label on that says Chalav Akum, and then nobody will eat it. But stealing is okay, but Chalav Akum, that's a chumrah. So that's going to be one of the options, interestingly enough, of how we classify Nama Aretz. Somebody who seems to be deeply committed to kind of the ritual laws, but not that concerned with interpersonal rules. The other view, which is going to be the rule we follow, the Rabbanan, says actually we define Amaratzut by somebody who's apathetic or lazy or can't be bothered to do anything. Which again, if we're trying to figure out, you're getting punished for crimes that make society fall apart. What's more damaging to society? Somebody who's more interested in ritual rules than interpersonal rules, or somebody who's lazy but knows them all? So that seems to be what the live debate might be here. So this is what they're debating. Marsava, one view says, Lo nachshadu ame ha'aretz al ma'aseh ani shel damai. So, well, actually, no. One view says that in ame ha'aretz, you're not. This is a view of Rabbi Elazar, who says you don't have to designate ma'aseh ani. He says you don't have to worry about them not separating damai. Kivin demamona hu afrushi mafrish. Because it's monetary, he will have separated it out, even though it's kept in there. Meaning the assumption is he knows he doesn't have to give it away. This is how sophisticated he is with the halachic principles. He says, Ma'aseh Ani is monetary. So I'll separate it out, and then I just won't give it to anybody. Because I've made the designation, and what's the crime if I eat it? Gzela. So I'll stick it back in my, what's the big deal? Truma, I'll take it out. If I eat it, what happens? Misa, so I'm going to give that away. So you don't have to worry about Truma. And the question is, do you have to worry that he didn't designate Ma'aseh Ani? And one view, Rabbi Elazar says, no, the assumption is he separated it out and he put it back in because that law is no cost to him. He's not going to lose anything because he can just stick it back in. It's just gzela, basically. So Afrushi Rashi, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to say that loud. That's Rabbi Elazar. Chachamim say, Rabbanan Savri, kiven de tricha le milta lo mafresh. He says, now, even you do have to worry. Truma, you're right, you don't have to worry because he knows about the death penalty, so he'll separate that out. But Ma'aseh Ani is going to think, I'm going to go through the whole issue of separating it out and sticking it back in. It's too much fuss. And I know there's no punishment, so I'm not going to bother. And that's Rabbi Elazar says, you do have to separate it aside. So they both seem to assume that this figure knows enough about the law, but is less concerned about monetary issue. And the question is, are they, on top of being committed to ritual problems and not interpersonal issues, are they lazy as well? And it seems to be for the Rabbanan, the view we follow is laziness is a key issue with Amaratzus. Full stop, bottom line was, if you eat from grain that you've not separated Ma'aseh Ani from, even though everything else is gone, you get lashes. You get malchus. It's not just malchus because we're worried you're going to eat sacred food and you're going to break the institutions of ritual service. But monetary issues are a problem too when it comes to grain. Full stop. There was a debate in the Mishnah, at the end of our Mishnah, Kama yochel min ha-tevel, how much tevel do you have to eat? And what would you assume, with general knowledge of Jewish law, how much tevel do you have to eat to be in violation? Kazayas would be the assumption, but there was a debate. Amr Bibi Amr Shimon ben Lakish. The debate in the Mishnah was, one person says, even if you eat one grain, one piece of grain, that was Reb Shimon, said you eat one grain, it's a problem. The other says it's got to be kazayas. So, Reb Shimon ben Shimon ben Lakish, Machloket Bechita, Reb Bibi said in the name of Reish Lakish. They're only debating if you eat one grain. Avo bekemach divra kol kazayas. But if you're talking about flour, everybody would of course agree you've got to eat a kazayas of flour. You can't eat like a, what would a bit of flour be called? A fleck. You can't say eating a fleck of flour would be a problem. Everyone agrees. Only if you're talking about kind of a stack of grain, one grain would be a problem. But everybody thinks if it's ground already, you have to eat a kazayas. Rabbi Yirmiyah, Rabbi Shimon Lakish, Rabbi Yirmiyah said in the name of Reish Lakish, that's not true. He says, according to Rabbi Shimon, if you eat a fleck of flour, you're a violation of a biblical crime. Tanan, and we've got a, hold on a minute, what did our Mishnah say? Says the Gemara, you're trying to adjudicate, would they argue just about a chita or not? Our Mishnah, Rabbi Shimon said, I'atem odim liba ochel, Namala kol shushu chayv. If you agree with me that eating an ant that is small, that you're chayv, meaning it's less than a kazayas, why do you not agree with me about a chita? Amar lo mimnei shuk priyat. They say, oh no, the reason that you're in violation if you eat one ant is because it's a beria, meaning it's a whole creature. You're right, it's not a kazayas, a little ant, but if you eat a whole ant, you're in violation of eating a beria, and you get a biblical crime for that. So Amalehen Afkita Afkriya, this is what I think, it sounds like, one grain is a barrier. So you should get punished for eating one grain. What does it sound like he would say if you were eating a fleck of flour? Not a problem, because it's not what we'd call a barrier. It seems to be minimally, it's a kazayas or a barrier, and I think a chita is a barrier. So chita in kemach lo. So this whole debate between Rav Bibri and Rav Yirmiyah about what Reish Lakish thinks seems to be moot on the basis of our Mishnah. He only thinks about a chita. The Gemara responds, actually, Ledivreim Kamalahu, he was only talking, according to the rabbis, you should agree with me. The rabbis say, you've got to have a kazayas to be in trouble. And he says, oh, you've got to have a kazayas to be in trouble? What about an ant? That's not a kazayas. Say, oh, yeah, well, you're right. With an ant, you're in trouble because it's a barrier. And he says, oh, well, then what about a grain? And we said, oh, so he thinks a grain's important. So the Gemara is saying, no, he thinks the whole idea, and this is radical, well, the whole idea of kazayas is not in play. Kazayas is only about punishment. But prohibition, biblical prohibition, less than the kazayas is in force. And the whole measure is irrelevant. But according to you, rabbis, who think it's either going to be kazayas or a barrier, what, surely a grain should count as a barrier. He says, Lidivrem kamalahu, lididi, according to me, afilu kemach nami, even if it's a fleck of flour, you'd be in trouble. Ela lididchu, but according to you, who thinks it's got to be a barrier, odili mir dechita achat priyati, you should agree that a grain is like a whole creature or a whole creation. Rabbanan, the rabbis respond, biryat neshama chashuva, chita lo chashuva. No, there is a big difference between one grain and one ant as a designating object. And what's the difference? Yeah, it seems to be that an ant has a neshama. Now, I'm not going to suggest that there's like an olam haba for ants on the basis of this, and you've got to, you know, deal with kind of metaphysical reality, but the Chazal are suggesting that there is a fundamental difference between inanimate objects, inanimate creation, and animate creation. And an ant, you eat a whole ant, you're in violation of something that if you eat a whole grain, you're not. And again, that's some food for thought, quite literally. Thank you. What is at stake if you eat a whole ant? That is not at stake if you eat a whole grain. And you could, leave that to you. You could think about, well, it would be a signal of a lack of sympathy or sensitivity on the part of the eater. If you're willing to eat a whole ant, maybe that would have a radically different effect on society than if you eat a whole grain as opposed to a kazayas. You could get into kind of the meat of this. Forgive that as well. So, say again. You'd eat the steak, right? That's true. Avoid this and go with the steak. So the Gemara finishes these last two lines dealing with that first Mishnah. Tanya Kavati to Rav Yirmiya. And actually, now that we said our Mishnah sounds like Rav Bibi, that they only argue about Achita, we're going to say there's a Braita that actually supports a view. The Rav Shimon thinks Kezias is not a measure other than for punishment. Rav Shimon Omer, Kol Shul Makos, Larmu Kezias Eli Inyan Korban. Forgive me, I misexpressed that. That Kezias is only to make you bring a Korban if you did it B'shogeg. But you get malchus if you eat less than a kezias. If you eat a tiny bit of food, usually we say you eat pig's prohibition. To get malchus, you need to eat a kezias. Rav Shimon says, no, you have a fleck of bacon, you get malchus. If you did it by accident, you have to have a kezias in order for you to bring a korban. And again, you could say, why? Because if you're doing it accidentally, your negligence only counts with a certain amount. That's a fair amount of commitment, negligently. But to be in violation of a crime intentionally, any amount will do. Full stop. End of reflection on that first Mishnah, which listed a whole all sorts of crimes for which there are curries involved on top and not. Mishnah number two. Ha'ochel, and a kind of a theme that will emerge from this Mishnah seems to be eating too quickly or in the wrong place. So ha'ochel b'kurim ashla koralem. If you eat b'kurim when you've not given the recitation, what's the recitation for b'kurim? What do you have to say when you bring b'kurim? Yeah, we're all going to say it in a couple of weeks. Arami over Avi, you would say four psukim from Devarim. If you say, my father was a wandering Aramean, I'm very grateful for this grain, you took it out of Egypt, etc., etc., etc. You say that, you can then eat Bikurim. What happens if I brought it to the Bet Mikdash and I didn't say the recitation? Can they now be eaten? If you eat them without saying the recitation, or if you eat some of these highest level of sacred meat, which is some korbanot that only kohanim can eat. Kachim kalim and maser sheni chutz lachoma. Oh, sorry. And if you ate that outside the klaim, outside the temple grounds, kachim kalim maser sheni chutz lachoma. And if you ate some of your shlamim or some of your maser sheni outside of Yerushalayim, hashavad eitzim bePesach atahor. Or if you broke the bones of your korban Pesach, harizel loka arbaim, you get lashes. So again, what connects all these things? You're eating outside of the temple grounds where it's meant to be eaten. You're eating outside of Yerushalayim where it's meant to be eaten. You're eating before you've given the recitation when it can be eaten. Or you're breaking the bone of the Korban Pesach. It seems to be there's like a haste in the realm of eating, or you're eating out of place. You get lashes. Ava hamotir b'tahor. But if you leave over, meaning you're not eating too quickly, you're eating too slowly. You leave over Tahor v'hashover b'tame, or if you break the bones of a korban pesach which you can't eat anyway because it's tame, einu loka arbam, you don't get lashes. Full stop. Hanotel emun abanim. This was the quote we had last week. If you take away the mother bird with the children, i.e., you didn't perform the mitzvah sending away the mother bird, rebuto meloka v'enu mishalek. He says you get lashes, and there's no point in putting them back and sending the mother bird away again. You're done. The chachamim ram, the sages say mishalek v'enu loka. No, you can send away. You can put them all back. Send away the mother bird. At that point, the mother bird think, oh, phew, we're all back. That was a small, that was traumatic, but now we're all together. And then you send away the mother bird, and then you can take away the eggs. You can do that, and you don't get lashes. The sages say, Zeh, well, this is the general law. Kol mitzvah lo ta'aseh sheish b'mekum asein chayvim aleim. If there is a remedy, you don't get lashes for it. You can remove the remedy. Now, the rest of this daf is essentially saying, whose view is this Mishnah? And saying, oh, it's his view. Let's quote a brighter that shows you it's his view. And there's like 25 lines of this brighter that got none to do with it, but it's part of the brighter, so we'll teach it anyway. So the Gemara begins. This whole Mishnah is a view of Rabbi Akiva, who has the view that if you have Bikurim and you don't say the recitation, you get Malchus. He said, okay, we didn't know whose view that was, but the Mishnah says if you eat Bikurim, whose view was the first Mishnah, by the way, in the Perek, and remember, where you can get Karis and Malchus at the same time? Very close. Rabbi Akiva. It was Dili Rabbi Shmuel, so you were close. But there were three views. You had Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Yitzchak. And we said, Rabbi Shmuel says, you can get Malchus and Misa together. Rabbi Yitzchak said you could get nothing together. You either get Malchus or Misa or Kares. And you had Rabbi Akiva in the middle of you says you can get Kares and Malchus together, but not Malchus and Misa. And we said, so that first mission is Rabbi Akiva. So we begin the second mission and say, oh, by the way, this is Rabbi Akiva too. And how do I know? Because he's got the view that if you haven't said the Mikra Bikurim, you haven't read the piece, you get lashes, which is, again, we're going to, it's a biblical crime to eat this food without having said, I'm grateful for it. Which you can say, who's being harmed by this? But if you don't have a gratitude deep in society, we mentioned at Sudha Shlishit yesterday, you can imagine the United States saying, anyone who doesn't eat turkey on Thanksgiving, we're going to give you lashes because we need to have a grateful country. And again, you could say, I don't know how effective that would be, and we spoke about that yesterday. But here, this is the principle. If you don't recite Mikra Bikurim and you eat Bikurim, you get lashes. And that's a view of Rabbi Akiva. And this is Rabbi Akiva, who we said at the beginning, at the end of the first parak, was queasy about Misa. Says, I would find a way never to give Misa, but he seems quite happy to give Malkus on this ground. The sages disagree with Rabbi Akiva, and they take the view you don't have to read it to avoid punishment, meaning you have to read it, but you don't get punished if you eat it without it. All you have to do is hanacha. You just have to put the bikurim down by the mizbeach, but if you didn't say the piece, you're not going to get lashes. It's putting down that's the key. The Gemara says, why do you have to say it's Rabbi Akiva? It's a review of Shimon, not the review of Rabbi Akiva. We've got a text that ties this view about Bikurim to Rabbi Shimon, and you're just on traditional ground saying, I know this is Rabbi Akiva. Hakamash Malan, then, when it says, no, what we were trying to suggest is, the Rabbi Akiva to Rabbi Shimon's Firulei, that Rabbi Akiva has that view that Rabbi Shimon had. Full stop. Now, the whole rest of this Amud is, my Rabbi Shimon, what's the view of Rabbi Shimon, where we know he says that if you don't read the Bikurim, you get lashes. And then it gives the rest of the brighter. So we start here where it says Ditanya, and all the way down to over the page in the yellow is going to be the brighter where Rabbi Shimon has this view. Ditanya says in a brighter, Chumat Yadecha, this is part of that pasuk we read on the previous Amud, which says, you cannot eat these various things. And including, it said, Chumat Yadcha, you can't eat the gift of your hand. What is that? Elu Bikurim, this is Bikurim, says the brighter, and Rashi says how we know that Trumat Yadecha means Bikurim. Rabbi Shimon says, Ma Bazalam Denu, what are we being taught in being told you can't eat Bikurim? Surely I should know you can't eat Bikurim. Im Lochlan Chutz L'chama, if we're being taught, oh, you can't eat them outside the wall of Jerusalem, Kavachom im Maaseh Akal. Maaseh Sheni is lenient, and you can't eat that outside. So obviously you can't eat Bikurim outside the wall. That can't be what it's teaching. Full stop. If you eat it without having recited, you get Malkus. So we've now proven that this is a view of Rabbi Shimon, that we said, oh, this is Rabbi Kiva who holds this view. We now have the rest of the brighter where Rabbi Shimon continues. The pasuk says, v'nid votecha, zu todo shlamim. It also says, you can't eat votecha. And we said, that's todo shlamim. Rabbi Shimon marbaz, what's it coming to teach? I know you can't eat todo ushlamim. Im lechon lechutz lechom. If it's about you can't eat outside the wall of Yushalayim, kavacham im masa. We get that. We know masa sheni, you can't. So of course, todo shlamim, you can't. Hello, ba'kadav el alokha b'todo shlamim lefnei zrika. So it's talking about if you eat them before you've sprinkled the blood on the altar, shuloka, which obviously doesn't apply to masa sheni, there's an extra prohibition. Or the prohibition still applies with Torah and Shlamim until you've done the Zrika on the Bet Mikdash. Uvachoron, it says you can't have Bechor, it's there Bechor. This is talking about the first animal, Bechor. Armub Shimon Bazelam Denu, what does it come to teach? Imloch and Achut Ramu is telling you can't eat the Bechor outside the wall of Shlam, Kavacham and Masa. We should learn this from Masa, which is obviously you can't eat outside the wall. If Nei Zrika, if you're going to say, oh, maybe you thought you could eat it before Zrika, Kavacham and Torah Shlamim. We've just said Torah and Shlamim, obviously, you can't eat before Zrika, so obviously Bechor you can't. So again, he's assuming that there is a logical inference from all these things, that Maaser is the most lenient, and that Todah Shlamim is more lenient than Bechor. And on the next page, we're going to have the Gemara say, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true, all the way through. But he continues, Kavacham Todah Shlamim, first word in line is Shlamim, exclamation point. Halabah Kadav Ela Ochel Min HaBechor, Afilu Acha Zrika. We're being taught, if you eat from the Bechor, even after Zrika, unless you're Kohen, Shuloka, you get Malkus. What about Chatar V'Asham? Rabbi Shimon Bar Zalman, what is this teaching us that you can't eat Chatar V'Asham? If it's telling you can't eat outside the walls of Yerushalayim, Kavacham M'Masa. We know from Masa you can't eat outside Yerushalayim. If you're going to say, oh, it's telling you can't eat it even until Zrika is done. Kavacham Todah Shlamim. Todah Shlamim is more lenient than Chatar V'Asham, and that you can't eat before Zrika. So obviously, if you're going to tell me you can't even eat after Zrika unless you're a Kohen, Kavacham M'Bechor. This is Bechor is more lenient, so obviously you can't eat it even after Zrika unless you're a Kohen. It's saying you can't eat it even after Zrika outside the Azara. Shuloka, you get lashes there. Nidarecha, what is your vow that you can't eat? Zil Ola. This is talking about Korban Ola. Who gets to eat the Korban Ola?
Nobody.
Nobody. So this is the most strict. I'm Reb Shimon Bazan. What is this coming to teach us? If it's saying you can't eat Ola outside the wall, we know you can't eat it for Masa. This sounds like a Chad Gadya. And if you're going to tell me, maybe it means even after Zerika, you can't eat outside the Azara. Obviously, because Chatad and Asham is more lenient than Ola, so you can't eat it then. What's it coming to teach us? That nobody can eat this ever. You get lashes. Full stop. So what Reb Shimon has done in this brayta is taken one pasuk and kind of, and he hasn't read it in order, by the way. It's kind of in reverse. He's gone backwards and forwards in the verse to say, this is more strict than this, so it can't be teaching that. This is more strict than this, so it can't be. And he's built this whole edifice of a logical inference all the way up to a pyramid, saying that there are lashes in various cases based on the premise that there are various levels of strictures in all of this. And Rava is blown away. Amar Rava. If somebody is pregnant with a child like Reb Shimon, tailored, they should give birth. Ve'ilolo tailored, and if not, they shouldn't. Meaning he's so blown away by this, everybody's kid should be like Reb Shimon. So he seems quite impressed. Va'afal gav de'ilu pircha. Even though you can rip apart this whole brayta, the Gemara is about to say, Reb Shimon's come up with this wonderful structure of exegetical theory that we're about to rip to shreds. And Rava says, but everybody's kids should be like this. And now the Gemara is going to say very quickly, how do we take apart all these assumptions? My churman to bikurim and masa. You're telling me, oh, bikurim is obviously more machmeh than masa, so you can learn from that. Bikushken asum lazarim. Because masa sheni can be eaten by everybody in Yerushalayim. Bikurim, wrong way around. Masa is asa la zarim. So why do we say masa hakal? That you learn from masa. Obviously, masa can't be eaten outside of Yerushalayim. They're talking about masa sheni. So bikurim, you can't. Oh no, I'm wrong. Who eats bikurim? The Kohen eats bikurim. So bikurim has to be eaten by Kohanim. That I mis-expressed that before. So sheken asurim la zarim. So bikurim is prohibited to everybody else apart from the Kohanim. So obviously, if Maaseh can't be eaten outside the walls, Bikurim can't be eaten outside the walls, that's an obvious inference. Adarabah, Maaseh Chama, maybe Maaseh is more, Shekein Asa La'onen, because there's a prohibition, who can't eat Maaseh Sheni? An Onen can't eat Maaseh Sheni. What if a Kohen is an Onen? He can still eat Bikurim, so you can't necessarily say Maaseh is more lenient, it's just different. And you were trying to also suggest, Reb Shimon, that Todah and Shlamim is more strict than Maaseh, so you can infer from that. Why? Because Todah and Shlamim, it involves rituals with the Mizbeach, which Maaseh Sheni does not. So maybe say Maaseh is strict in a different way. Because if you're going to redeem Maaseh Sheni, you have to use a certain kind of currency, which is not true if you're trying to redeem another Korban. So maybe Maaseh Sheni is more strict. You were trying to say a Bechor is more strict than a Todah Shlamim. So if Todah Shlamim you can't eat Lifnei Zrika, of course Bechor you can't eat Lifnei Zrika. Because Shken Ketuv Shetami Rechem. And you were going to say because Bechor is more strict because it is, when is the Bechor designated as Kodesh? The firstborn animal. When do I know that that's going to have to be taken to the Bet Mikdash? Yeah, because it's the Bechor, it's the firstborn. It's by definition Kodesh. Todah and Shlamim, when is that Kodesh? When I say so. So you'd think Bechor is more strict. Adarabah, maybe not. Maybe Todah and Shlamim Chamor. Maybe even though Todah and Shlamim is designated later, it's more Chamor, because Shkentun and Smicha and Nechazim is Tumvet Chazik Vishok. There are rituals associated with it that do not apply to a Bechor. So who knows? Umaychem and Nechad of Asham and Bechor. And you were trying to say that Chad and Asham is more strict than the Bechor. Why? Shekein Kodesh Kachim. Because it is has to be eaten in a certain area of the Beit Mikdash and treated in a certain way and eaten in a certain time period. Adrabah b'chor chama, maybe b'chor is more strict. Shekein kedusha tamirechem, because it's designated from, meaning all the edifice that Reb Shimon has built on the basis that this is stricter than this, this is stricter than this, those are all flimsy assumptions. They're different in various ways. So Maaseh Sheni, you might say, oh, well, Maaseh Sheni, anybody can eat that. So that's more lenient. At the same time, Maaseh Sheni can't be eaten by an Onen. So it can't be eaten by anybody at any time, whereas Bikurim can be eaten by, at any time by a Kohen, but there's just some people who can't. So who are you to say what's more strict? And you're assuming the Ola is the most strict, because it's entirely burnt up on the altar. No one gets to eat it. Maybe Chatan Asham is Mochamer Shekin Mechapri, because they perform atonement in a way that an Ola might not. And maybe they're all stricter than Ola, because there are various ways in which it's eaten, not just on the altar, but also by people. And maybe that's more Machmir, maybe that's more important than an Ola. You've got all these assumptions baked into your structure, Reb Shimon. So the Gemara responds, Elamai Dilady Imek Reb Shimon, why on earth did Rava say everybody should give birth to children like this if his assumptions are all wrong? Because who thinks like that, to break a pasuk up in that way and to make inferences back and forth? Meaning, we're praising here his ingenuity and his creative reading rather than his correct assumptions, which is an interesting side point. Last reflection, and hold on a minute, the whole idea that you say, oh, you're going to get lashes for this because kavachoma from that. There's a premise you can't give, that we've stated a few times to the Masechta. You can't give malchus on the basis of an inference, because you can never imply anything about law. Who knows what's strict for God? Unless it's warned directly in the text, you can't give malchus. There is a view that you can give an onesh based on an inference if there's an azhara, but here there's no warning. You're giving warnings on the basis, of a kavachoma. Isura ba'alma. So you're right. Kuntra Shimon, he's not saying you get lashes. He's saying that there's a prohibition involved in all these things, but we wouldn't enforce it under penalty. But hold on, Rava says that you get malchus, loke. Nah, it doesn't mean it. Chamisha asurin havu. He means that there are five prohibitions, not that you get five lashes. Full stop. Next week, please God, we'll get on to Daf Yud Chet, and we start heading towards the final stretch of the Masechta. We will not finish before Pesach, because there's 2 weeks till Pesach, which means we've got two more sessions, which means we'll get to Yutet. We will finish, please God, in time to make a Siyum on Shavuos. But in the meantime, I wish you all a wonderful week, and we'll pick up next time. We're doing benching. Yeah. Who wants to lead?